Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Well, welcome back, and it's now or never. As you know, we're losing time. As a matter of fact, you know the old saying, opportunity costs, right? We have to make our own decisions of what we're going to do, right? I mean, I can't compel anybody to act. It's not like we can call the Marines in. Now, the Marines, if they're ordered, they will go in. They'll do what they're told. We don't have a force like that. We have to be that force. I can't make it any simpler. We need you. We need you to get smart, get educated, get invigorated, and act. Now, I've said this before, and I think I just covered this, but the more I think about it, how is it? What is a Republican form of government? A Republican form of government means that we are represented. The question I have is, are you being represented or is the party being represented? Do we have a party form of government? Do we have to align with the party platforms and agendas? Or should we allow a partisan behavior within our halls of government? Should we basically dictate that they cannot divide themselves aligning with factions formally? And so we need to make sure that, you know, because everybody has these labels. But what will end up happening is that we'll find that people start, and this is why I know I'm speaking in sentence fragments, but this is why constitutional compliance is foremost. Because if we're actually looking at what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional, then why in the heck does our government have all of these committees regarding things that they have no delegated authority or power over? Why? Why do we allow that? Why did we allow Congress to investigate the Major League Baseball over steroids or over all of these other little things? The question the real answer is that some people, you know, asked them to do it, and the rest of the nation actually just looked in shock and too many in awe over the power of our government. They don't have that power. So how is it they're getting away with it? Because we're not telling them they don't have that power. As soon as we start asserting our authority over them, then we're going to find that things are going to be a lot better. Now, when you look at the committees, you look at, you know, the elections, I think we need to sit down and have an open conversation of what it would take to start rooting out and making it hard for the parties to be so successful in controlling us. One of those things is taking away the primary. Because if you take away the primary, then they don't have a chance to set their stage to hedge their bets. Everybody's open. And it goes down this path. And you know what, folks? I'm better. I believe we are better off if we allow Congress, our newly elected representatives, choose the president and the vice president. Do you understand what I just said? We are better off allowing them to do it because we could actually have and force. If we got rid of the primaries and we had a point where it was just, you know, that many people that we couldn't get a consensus because we had literally 50 and they couldn't downsize it to get an actual constitutional electoral college to choose the president, then it would go to the House of Representatives. and it would be simplified. And how is your congressional representative any different than your elector? Your elector is basically based upon how many representatives you have. The problem is our representation. The party has stifled our representation to where we have to fight. We have to fight a quarter, 3/4 of a million other people to be heard. So you better come strong. You better come with a big check. How big of a check do you have to write if it's 30,000 people? And now you start seeing the point of why our government was designed the way it was, to constrain representation so that they couldn't actually control so many people that the people were literally silenced. Because the majority of the people don't have the money to pay for government, and the majority of the people don't like what is being paid for. Over time, though, they create this, I'll just say, a market space of takers. Because in our form of government, we're not supposed to have takers and makers. Everybody is equal. But they've gone down this path of creating a socialistic state. It's not. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. But they've done it because government is now basically providing unconstitutionally welfare. And so, as they've convinced farmers to take subsidies, if they've convinced railroad companies to take subsidies, over 100 years ago, we're working on 200 years when they started getting involved in railroads and subsidizing. That's how long they've been doing this stuff. So my point is that as, you know, as they've created socialism, first in businesses, what were considered critical businesses, and now critical essential things such as, you know, your housing, living in a government-subsidized house, living in or having government-subsidized meals with food stamps. They have created a body of takers to take from you, the makers. They don't have the authority to do that. And as they do so, now they have these, and by using the parties, they move the agendas to enable the takers more and more. It is a very maniacal plan. And so we really need to start taking this on. And I would like to start seeing a movement that challenges the state funding from the taxpayers, because let's go to the rolls. Let's prove now in your state how many people are actually card carrying. I don't care how they vote. I don't care how people vote. I care about whether people are actually paying to be a part of that party. If not, then the party has to pay. They have to pay, and they should anyway. They should pay for their own primaries, because what they do is they make it, especially these top two states. The top two states basically have catered completely and locked out all third parties. We need to get back to a representative government, not a party form of government. And so there needs to be these legal challenges, folks, or better yet, First Amendment petitions. What is a First Amendment petition anyway? It is a legal challenge. It is a constitutional, which means legal. It is a challenge of the law, demanding that the public servants and the government itself is violating the law and demanding that it fix itself. So anyway, this is why I tell you that, you know, when we start going, this is what we're going to be doing today. We're going to be getting into the petitions. We're going to get into the overall strategy, because we kind of talked about this. And next week we have the Bill of Rights. So we'll probably take some time aside to kind of go through really the Bill of Rights and some history on the Bill of Rights, just to help commemorate on the 15th the Bill of Rights. Now hopefully I'll remember that. But anyway, we have the ability, we have the opportunity to actually make some of these things happen. We can do this, folks. We can do this. Anyway, I mentioned this before, and I just want to kind of cover this, just trying to cover some obligatories. I talked about having a national call and bringing everybody together and asking everybody to kind of participate in this call, because I think we have a strong consensus, at least amongst a few people, to where I think it's important that we, and I want to open this up. And if you want to be on an open mic, then you need to send me an email and your phone number. You can sit and listen, but what we want you to do is we want you to ask questions. And the way to ask a question, and actually so you can ask the question, is you need to email me and then have an open mic, you know, because that way I can look at what your phone number is. And when you dial in, we'll give you the access so that you can ask your question. Because the best way to actually constrain, you know, hecklers and or, you know, people that don't have a question, that just want to be grandstanding, because I don't want the progressives to dial in and basically, you know, counteract us. So what we want to do is we want to make it so that we control, you know, who is able to speak. And it's going to be an open forum. And so all I request is people kind of either raise their hand or what have you to talk. And what I'll do is I'll actually try to create a upfront itinerary of whose questions. So we'll kind of show everybody the itinerary, and then we'll go through the questions and then any add-on questions that somebody may have had, and they can either put that into the chat and or what have you. But what we want to do is we want to make this so that you become a contributor. We'll be right back after these messages.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
I hate it when I bleed into the promos. But anyway, I obviously try to squeeze some last minute or these comments into before the break. But anywho, and so what we want to do is we want to make sure that you have an equal opportunity to be a participant and to get involved and to start leading in your local area. We want to enable and help you. Contrary to enabling and helping the takers and those non-productive and the parasites in our society. And these parasites are human beings that have been trained and manipulated into these positions because they're offering, they're bribing them. These people are selling their souls for this opportunity to be able to get free handouts and to be on this pathway of some opportunity of leadership. You know, I mean, when you look at it, some people call it and refer to it as organized crime. This is how organized crime works. They go and get, they give you a favor and you owe them. And then they come back and start collecting on that. And then every time they collect, they now have that over your head. Then they have the next one and they get you to kill. And you start doing really evil things. Well, government's doing the same thing. Getting you to become dependent on them is probably one of the most evil things that a person can do. There's nothing more righteous. Nothing more righteous for a person to actually go out and earn their own way and pay for their own home, pay for their own food, and pay for, everything that they want and be able to earn those things that they want instead of, this has got to be the most inhumane thing I've ever seen. People pleading and begging for a stipend of food, or people pleading and begging because they've been subjugated to that point. Now, folks, yeah, you may be getting your free phones and so forth, but the day will come when the takers destroy the makers. In other words, we get to a point where the makers can no longer make enough for everybody. What that means is when we start shifting away from the mass population doing this and going to government and government businesses and corporations, then now you're going to be conscripted to work because we got to provide for everybody. And what will end up happening is these poor makers or these poor takers out there that are dependent, they're going to actually have to be forced to do what you work. And because all of the humanity goes down the drain when we become enslaved to the state. Statism is the complete loss of humanity. There's nothing more humane than a person raising their own food, raising their children, doing everything they can to contribute to society. Those who live in society to take from it are a scourge, but they're not a scourge in some cases on their own. They've been manipulated. Now we've got generational scourge because kids have been brought up in a system that they've been completely dependent on, and they've been taught how to game the system at this point. I mean, how do you think we got Antifa? I mean, I have a hard time believing that these people were actually, I guess it's possible that they were successful entrepreneurs, and then they surrendered themselves to an ideology, because ideologies can do that, but I just doubt it. I'd have to do the due diligence, but it just doesn't play out. I believe that the people that end up rising up as a tool for statism, because that's what Antifa is. That's what these protesters, that's what the libertarian movement is. Contrary to what the libertarians tell you, the Libertarian Party is a party that embraces chaos. You see them, these pseudo-intellectuals out there, talking down their nose at, all these people that, have these arcane ideas and concepts of liberty. What they want is they want a society with no rules. You don't have to have a driver's license. You don't have to have, all of these, controls and regulations. Are you kidding me? The state has all powers not delegated to the federal government, but it's based on the powers we delegate to them. And if we give them the ability to build roads, then they have the ability to regulate them. Now, the federal government they may be building them, but they don't have the ability to regulate or even build. They've crossed that line. You need to watch my three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation. With that, let me get into the exit criteria, because that's what we were talking about when we were disconnecting yesterday. There are basically four things, and there's more than this, but there's basically four things that I think have to occur for your county to become, and again, there is more than this, but for your county to truly become a constitutional county, to be firing on all cylinders, the first and foremost, we have to have a militia, and a militia that is responsible to the sheriff, a politically appointed person, of executing the laws of the county and ensuring that those laws are within the Constitution. So understanding what is within the Constitution, we're going to have common law courts and common law grand juries. We're going to need to have a common law grand jury that is going to basically have to go through and definitize what the Constitution is. And we're going to get into definitizing it and why that is important, so that the sheriff knows exactly how and what to enforce. Is this really constitutional? You know what? I ask people, is this I'll ask people a question. Is this thing here, and I'm being ambiguous, is this constitutional? And they'll go, well, yeah, sure. Like an HOA. Can an HOA, if you sign an HOA, that you won't be able to, you know, have a chicken coop on your property? Can't have them. Is that constitutional? Yeah, sure. People really believe those things. Can you really be conscripted to, you know, surrender your property in the United States to an HOA, to a private organization, or to a public organization, or a government organization? And the reality is, no, you cannot. Now, you can join a club, a private club, and do those types of things, but you're not conscripted to that club. In other words, you can't be compelled to be a member of that club. And you can't be compelled in your participation, everything else. You have the freedom to walk in and the freedom to walk out at any point in time. No club can take away your sovereignty in choosing to be a part of or to no longer be a part of. So you can't be conscripted. But you can join a church. And you can join a church and be told this is what you have to do, or whatever club you want to have, whether it be a golfing club. Because those are private. They're not open to the public. But the overall rules, the overall, you know, ceremonies, whatever it is they do, the government can have you divulge those things. Why? Because they want to make sure that what you're doing does not violate the rights of the individuals. And make sure that you're not actually planning against them. So you're supposed to disclose those types of things. anyway, because the government, whenever an institution or organization is created, the government does have oversight. They have a responsibility. Remember, what is the two primary objects of government? Your state government, your local government, your county government. It is to protect life and to protect private property, right? Okay, so if an institution is created, they want to make sure that that institution is not going to take your private property or take your life. And so they want to understand, what is it you're doing? Why are you doing this? And so forth. And that's none of their business if it's some form of religious worship or what have you. But it is their business if this form of religious worship is going to take away other people's ability to buy bacon. Other people's ability to be able to make choices for themselves while they're on the, you know, in the area, within the town, or what have you. Anyway, let's move on. So we've got the militia kind of covered. We've gone through this in common law courts and the common law grand jury. Now, who convenes the common law grand jury? Now, if you can't get your county commissioners to convene a common law grand jury, you can get your sheriff to do so. The problem with the sheriff doing so is he doesn't have the funding. He has to surrender his own funding to do it. The county commissioners, because they control the purse strings of the county, they can come up with the money to actually fund and operate common law courts and common law grand juries. Now, as we look at the other two criterias, these are just kind of like, oh, yeah, that's obvious. If government actually becomes accountable and actually starts doing what we demand that they do, then they will have an office of management of First Amendment petitions. In other words, when you turn in a petition, they will look at that and they go, okay, we're going to make sure that every public servant is, you know, aware of, you know, this problem. Because 9 times out of 10, by the time you're at this point where there's an office, there's not going to be very many people in your county that aren't complying to the Constitution. So all of these First Amendment petitions will then be handed to your county commissioners, and then, you know, they'll have a what we'll call a milk run because after a while, they're going to realize that they're going to have to go, because they just can't go every time you turn in a petition. But they can have a milk run to basically say, okay, every Friday we'll head over to the state capitol and we'll turn in these petitions and we will actually, you know, execute the criteria within the petitions. And so that way they can check the blanks, they can actually hand out the forms, make the recipient sign for and acknowledge their responsibility, blah, blah, blah. And so bottom line, you know, when they actually come with these things, well, I don't want to bleed into the break, so we'll be right back after, and we'll talk more about the milk run right after these two promos. Thank you so much.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let me kind of describe what a milk run is. In the military, the Air Force, the Navy, whoever has and runs transport jets, they call those milk runs. And a milk run is where you just have a hard scheduled trip that you're going to go over there and do the county business at the state house. And that's what we're talking about, a county commissioner milk run to the state legislature so that they can go do business for you, the people. Now, technically, a part of this milk run has to be, and a part of this criteria in these milk runs, and actually I need to add this, so we have five things because we need to restore the county committeeman. And the county committeeman is the guy that, or the guy and gal, because technically today you have a county committee man and a county committee woman. Now the parties have completely absconded these, but the people should be electing their county committeeman and county committee woman. And they would technically be the most appropriate people to constantly go over and do the business for the people. In other words, here's two people that are chosen to actually go represent them to the state house over the issues that the county commissioners, so they work with the county commissioners, and the county commissioners kind of, you know, set their priorities along with we the people. So in other words, as you start committing and start submitting these petitions, as they go over on their standard run, and the county commissioners can go over as well, but the real people that are supposed to be doing the representation at the state house, those people are your county committeemen, county committee woman, however you want to, you know, you want to have that dual gender county committee person. Doesn't matter to me. What matters is that we restore these functions. So the county committeemen and then these milk runs. And that way, when you start submitting, because you want to drive what they're going to be talking about, what they have to do, you do that with your First Amendment petitions, because every First Amendment petition that requires to be, you know, handed over and basically providing the criteria. So what is the providing the criteria? So in the petition, if you demand that your state legislators acknowledge this requirement and either commit to or refuse to, you know, acquiesce and or do what you tell them to do, to vote a certain way or not. And if they've, you know, if they've proved to, if they say they're going to vote a certain way or introduce a bill or whatever it is, then they have to provide the evidence the next time those guys go back. So you kind of bake these things into your First Amendment petitions of setting expectations. I expect you to do X, Y, Z and provide me with, you know, a 1, 2, 3 type of, you know, product. So this way we have clarity as to whether our public servants are, because we can't give them wiggle room. Folks, when you give somebody, when you give an employee wiggle room, if you've ever had an employee like that, if you've ever been that employee, you know what latitude you can get. Oh, well, you didn't tell me what time I had to do it. Or you didn't tell me, you know, specifically how to do it. So I did it the way I wanted. Now, usually employees like that don't last long, but that's because the employee, they're right there in front of the employer, and the, and you, the employer, gets really frustrated. But the fact of the matter is, because you have no expectations other than you just voted them to go and be away from you for 2 years or four, then what are your expectations? This is how we actually start taking control. If you can understand how beautiful this is, when we actually tell them what they have to do, when they have to acknowledge their legal obligation in supporting the Constitution, and we hold them accountable to it, can you not see the divine hand of Providence's DNA in this process of what he's given us? This is where the First Amendment petition, the legal oath of office of Article 6, and the holding them accountable in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment closes the loop. This is where we now have them where we want them. But why is it we haven't been doing this? Because they knew what had happened in the 14th Amendment, and they want you to believe that the 14th Amendment is really bad. And now that I've been harping on this for years, we're now at a point where we're starting to hear people whispering, using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as a weapon to do bad things. And my point is, if Congress actually uses Section 3 nefariously, then that right there is absolute rebellion against the Constitution. When they start actually going after people for political purposes and not because they are committing an insurrection, in other words, they themselves are insurrecting by using Section 3 as a weapon instead of impeachment. Because you can always impeach somebody for the behavior you don't like. But when it comes down to supporting the Constitution or failing to support it, that's precisely what Section 3 is for. This is why Section 3 really replaces your need to use impeachment. When somebody violates their oath of office, it's done. They're gone. They don't get due process. They do not have a right to protect their position. They have been removed from that position because they have violated the standard of fulfilling their oath, their legal obligation of supporting the Constitution. So the last criteria that is essential is the Constitutional Compliance Office. So the Constitutional Compliance Office will be created, and like I said, a grand jury can actually definitize the Constitution. This is going to be some work, and we'll get into this again. We'll start in this show, and we're going to be going through all of the different strategies. Now, it took me months to go through this in the springtime. I probably won't be spending that amount of time because I want to get through this before the end of the year. And I still have Christmas. I've got the Bill of Rights. And I don't know if the Fair Tax folks are going to be coming on, but I've invited them to come on so that they can explain to you, the audience, and what they're trying to do and how they're going to do this and how they're going to change our entire tax system. And I hope it's constitutional. I hope what they're talking about doing is a constitutional process. And so anyway, what we want to do is create this Constitutional Compliance Office. And why is that important? Because this office can then provide guidance to the businesses in the county. It can provide guidance to the parties in the county, all grassroots activists, every public servant that wants to know, is this constitutional or that constitutional? And bottom line, when it comes down to definitizing the Constitution, once this is done, and who's this going to be done by? This isn't going to be done by GR. This is going to be done by a body of people that become educated on what the Constitution and how the Constitution was defined by the framers. So people are actually going to have to go through this, and they're going to have to not necessarily be sequestered, but this will take some time to get people to actually read, you know, and going through this and presenting all of this information so that we can actually definitize, you know, as concisely as possible what every line of that Constitution means, and take away any jurist's ability to say, oh, well, it's ambiguous and we interpret what they said here to mean this. No, they already interpreted that for you. They defined that, and that interpretation was what was accepted in ratifying this compact. That is what's legally binding. Anyway, so this Constitutional Compliance Office will be created, and then over time, once we have enough counties that have Constitutional Compliance Offices, by that point in time, once we get enough out to the counties, the state will set up the office. They will become the single repository for all counties, and then the state will then create or mandate that every county have an interface office and basically pull up all the resources, and everything else will be really at the state level online. And so that all the counties can then, because the counties can share, you know, over time, that, you know, as more and more counties create these offices, they can start sharing resources. But ultimately, this has to be done by the state. So the state will then incorporate this, and the counties, but will still maintain that office, so that when a question comes along, when somebody comes along and says, the federal government wants to do this, is this constitutional? Boom, 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 boom. It'll go through this model or go through this flow chart and say, do they have the authority to do this? No, then no, they can't. It does it fall under this power? Possibly. No, then no, they can't. So, I mean, at least there will be a clear, concise process of delineating what is constitutional and what isn't constitutional. Now, two things I want to cover before we start getting into the definitizing the Constitution. First and foremost, this show is also sponsored by republicreview.org, and you're listening to the only show that gives you the constitutional evidence and the constitutional empirical evidence of what is necessary to do the solutions in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution. And so now, definitizing the Constitution. There's another word for this. You could call it canonizing, just like how King James canonized the Bible. And so when we look at the canonizing process or the definitizing process, this is where we come up with a hard, fast definition of what is the Constitution and what everything means. And as soon as we come back, we're going to let you know why this is important so that everybody knows why we have to do this. We'll be right back after this.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so definitizing the Constitution, what we have to do is we have to actually take away the ability for the federal government to make up as they go along how they want to enforce their own Constitution. And believe it or not, their Constitution does not jive with the original Constitution that was ratified by the states. What this Constitution that they've created is called, it is called the Annotated Constitution. Now, when you hear people talk about a Constitution, the concept, I forget who dubbed this, it goes back to a Supreme Court jurist that talked about the Constitution being a living document. And I believe that over time, a long time ago, the Supreme Court decided that they, as they started creating these interpretations, they were basically going to galvanize their views of the Constitution and how they interpreted it as the law of the land. Now, near as I can tell, folks, that authority does not exist. The only authority that exists is what is in the Constitution. Do they have that delegated to them so they can define and interpret and decide what it means? No. Either it is in there or it isn't in there. They can't grant themselves jurisdiction over something they don't have. So, and technically, as it was sold, by John Marshall stated, hey, if something comes to the, if, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is what John Marshall said. If something comes to the jurist, to the Supreme Court, that is not within the enumerated powers, then they would declare it not under their jurisdiction, and they would consider the law or whatever it is void. Now, he said that, and then as soon as he became a Supreme Court justice, he started making opinions and laws. Actually, they didn't become law until they started applying case law and precedents by federal fiat. There's nowhere in the Constitution where that allows the court to declare what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional. They can only declare whether something is within their jurisdiction and whether that within their jurisdiction, that is how it has been defined. There really is no room for them to even interpret. If they had questions, if there was a question as to what that meant in the Constitution, their obligation was at the within the Constitution itself and how it was sold. In other words, the standard books, the standard files that the Supreme Court should have possessed when they looked at cases and when they go back into deliberating to determine what to do, the only things that they should be referencing are the ratification debates. Not the Federalist Papers, not international law, not prevailing opinions or science, you know, science journals or anything like that. Is it within their jurisdiction? So when it comes to climate change, when it comes to the environment, anything of that scope shouldn't even be in front of them. As a matter of fact, when those papers come, the clerk should have complete guidance to kick these things back and say, not within our jurisdiction. So when Roe v. Wade went into the Supreme Court bucket, it should have been quickly kicked back to the state to say, this is not a federal jurisdiction case. These are not within the enumerated powers, period. You can try to tie them to it, but you can't do that. You can't make implications that this is a tied to a 14th or some right to privacy or anything like that. And technically, the 14th Amendment doesn't create anything. The 14th Amendment only basically points out that these privileges and immunities that are within the Constitution, you cannot tell me the right to privacy, a blank right to privacy is within the Constitution, other than a person has a right to be secure in their person and their effects. So when you go, so this whole Roe v. Wade thing made this huge leap that said, I have this right to be secure in my person, but I go to this community, you know, abortion clinic, I still have that right of privacy when I'm out in public or in an institution that's publicly ran. Remember, the 14th Amendment made it impossible for any state or any sub-organization within that state to make a law and or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. The right of privacy, when you go into that, doesn't necessarily exist. It doesn't necessarily exist, especially if there is an underlying law that says a baby cannot be killed. That in itself is protecting life, and that actually is copacetic, as far as I'm concerned, with the law, the supreme law of the land, of the Constitution. Protecting life is paramount. And so this whole challenge of whether a mother can kill her baby or not is a state issue and an issue left to the people. You can't use the Constitution to violate something so essential as life itself. So as we go through this grand jury process of definitizing the Constitution, this grand jury will actually go through how each line was defined and actually tie it by footnote within the Constitution. So what we will see is at the end of each line, there'll be a little box with the different footnotes for either a clause for, you know, or actually not even just at the end of the line, like the uniformity clause, there's this little portion of uniformity that there'll be a little box there for the clause, and then there'll be a box for the entire sentence. And so what we'll have to do is we'll probably need to look at some color coding with a clause type of definition and clarity or clarification, and then a phrase. And when I say a phrase, like standing army, what does a standing army mean? Because they clearly defined this. And this is where we need to also inject as a part of subtext, because during the ratification debates, they went further in clarifying what it meant regarding a militia and what martial law was and how it was defined. Therefore, in that subtext, when we talk about martial law, even though it's not mentioned in the Constitution and the federal government thinks that they can just make up how they want to execute martial law, they cannot, because it was already stipulated in the Constitution what they could do and what they couldn't do. This ties the hands of the justices. This ties the hands of our court system from being able to interpret and take us down any path that they want to with judicial activism. This is how we remove them when they go outside the bounds of the hard defined clarifications that were provided at all of the different states. Folks, don't worry. We will not have any conflicts. I'm telling you that every state was harmonious in how they defined each little aspect of that Constitution. And it all supports everything I've been telling you. This is why we go through these things all the time. The next step is definitizing the 28 amendments. Now we have to actually go through, and obviously, I believe that the first 12 amendments are hardcore, we don't have to audit. But the 13th, the original 13th Amendment, as well as the one we call the 13th and 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, they all have to basically be going through so that we can prove when the state originally ratified. Now, there may have been an attempt of rejecting, but I'm just telling you, because like with the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment was the only amendment that has been rejected unconstitutionally. And what I mean by that is states tried to reject, they tried to change their position after they formally told the federal government, which means that if the federal government did not accept that rejection, their ratification stands. In other words, if the federal government doesn't open the door to say you can't go back and change your mind, the Constitution doesn't allow you. You ratified it for whatever reason. You have to be very sure and concise with what you're doing because you can't change your mind. Well, that existed on all amendments until the 17th Amendment. And so we kind of talk about this, and I have an article on Reclaiming the Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and my constitutional articles page and read my article regarding rescinding the 17th Amendment. I know it's kind of, you know, it's a rough, but read that and I think you'll understand that we actually have an opportunity to rescind, to remove an amendment that's currently in the pile of amendments without having to repeal it. We can actually undo it because the dolt in chief, the guy that is unconstitutionally seated in that White House currently, opened the door by using his moxie, by using his, what do you want to call that, his mob boss mentality, and he went in and basically yammered Congress and the office of Congress in accepting Delaware's formal rejection of the rescinding their formal rejection of the 17th Amendment and formally ratifying it in 2010. And because he used his leverage to make that happen, it's opened the door for all states to be able to change their position. That never happened with the 14th Amendment, folks. So there's a stark difference between the 14th Amendment and the 17th Amendment. And I'm telling you this because this also shows the divine hand of providence involved in the good and bad amendments, because he's actually given us a way to getting rid of the 17th Amendment. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we'll be back with more of these strategies of petitioning your government.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.